Okay, so this morning we're going to talk about a couple things. We're going to talk about, and I've mentioned this throughout the semester, and by the way, if you guys can't hear me, let me know. I'm trying to, since I'm in a hotel room, I don't want to wake up all the neighbors by, so try not to be too loud. But anyway, like I said, throughout the semester I've talked about occasionally raised copyrights. When we looked at the B101, we looked over Article 7, which was about your ownership of the drawings and the documents, and so I'm going to go into it a little more detail today, kind of to stress the importance of it. Again, I think it's one of the things that that architects, they recognize, but they don't understand probably some of the significance of it. They recognize that they own the drawings and how they're used on the project. But as the example that I raised with the one of my clients years ago, the reflective ceiling plan, there's quite a bit of power that you get from ownership of your drawings and how you can use that for both your benefit for getting clients as well as protection about clients taking things or other architects taking things away from you and a loss of revenue stream. So as a result of that, I kind of create a separate lecture just about this and kind of go through that, to those points. So, and then the second half of today, as I said, we won't be on the exam, so I'll just shut off the microphone and we'll just go through the sample agreement I sent to you guys. This is something to be used for whenever, if ever, you guys are hanging your own shingle or talking to the people at your company or what have you. There's some good benefits of that document. It's the kitchen sink, and so you can cut and paste and use just different provisions for different types of projects. But I'll go through that, and then you guys can keep that going forward. So, first of all, let's talk about copyrights. So, and this kind of goes back to our very first lecture when we talked about the hierarchy of laws. What a lot of people don't understand is actually copyrights and patents are in the Constitution. So it starts out in that very first hierarchy, and constitutionally then the legislature over the decades decided they wanted to have more specificity to what's specifically in the Constitution. So then they created the United States Copyright Act. And then there's, as I see up here, I talk about the foreign equivalents. Most of the larger industrialized countries have their own copyright acts. Some are a little bit more forgiving, or maybe not forgiving is not the best word. I would say more likely to say permeable than others. So if you're in some of the Far East countries, China, Taiwan, those types, when I say permeable, they're less restrictive on people. So there can be significantly more copyright infringement, patent infringement, trademark infringement that would be looked at here as improper and not in accordance with the acts. But over there, not as much. But the act itself is a federal law, so anything that comes up under a copyright violation, you would have to file a claim in federal court. There are, and this is separate, but I just wanted to raise it. So in the world of intellectual property, we have real property, which is, you know, your real estate or a tangible good, like a computer or a car or a house. Well, the house falls under real property, the property state, but tangible goods is something you can hold on to. And then there's intellectual property. And the intellectual property, well, you own a copyright. It's not the physical piece of paper that it's on. It's the actual design of what it is. And so that's something that you, for lack of better description, you hold inside your brain. So that's why they call it intellectual property. But all of those fall within the federal law, the federal system. Now, different states will have their own acts on trade dress and trade violations. So as a, like a trademark, so there may be a trademark statute in a state. There may be a trade dress or trade infringement within a state law. But there also is the federal law for that. For this purposes, we're only going to talk about the Copyright Act, although there are some arguments to be made that certain designs that you might put together as an architect could, in addition to enjoying copyright protection, could enjoy trade dress protection and could enjoy patent protection as a workable good, depending on what you design. Maybe you designed a system of how a door opens, and that may be a patentable type of design. But for purposes mostly of what we're going to do today, we'll talk about copyrights. The U.S. Copyright Act was amended in 1990 to specifically include architecture and architectural design and architectural ideas. It wasn't that prior to 1990, the Architectural Works Copyright Act is the specific subset of what it was called. It wasn't that architectural designs were not copyrightable prior to that. It's just that, once again, as the case law started coming down and the disputes that arose related to copyright infringement in the design world came up and the defenses that were being put together, the legislature came in and said we need to have more specificity on what is an infringement of an architectural design versus an infringement of a painting, or a book, or a computer program, or whatever you might say. So as a little kind of explanation of that, of why they created the Architectural Works Copyright Act, if you take a painting, you paint it, you can visually see it, and if somebody copies that, whether they photocopy it and sell it, whether they put it side by side and do the painting and copy it specifically for painting or otherwise, you can see the actual image that was painted, or the book that was written, or the photograph, or the record, or whatever it might be, and you can see that it's actually been copied. What was happening in the architectural world prior to the Architectural Works Copyright Act in 1990 is, let's say you designed a building, and the building was completed, and one of the elements, and we'll get there in a minute, is you have to have access to the copyrighted work. Well, the building itself was not considered a copyrighted work. It was the actual drawings that were filed with the U.S. Copyright Office. And so someone could actually technically copy your design by looking at a building or measuring it out, even though you would think that the building itself was a just different representation or manifestation of the copyright that you had in the drawings and plans and specifications. So there was a number of lawsuits that came down, mostly dealing with residential homes. Somebody would develop a subdivision. In the subdivision, there would be the five different styles of homes: the colonial, the ranch, the Georgian, whatever it might be. And that developer would build that subdivision, and then some other developer would come in and take pictures of those buildings and measure those buildings out, walk in the model and figure out how the rooms were laid out in the flow, or they would even take the pamphlet that had a very basic rudimentary drawing of the layout of the house, and then they would copy those and build their own subdivision just down the road or across the country or what have you. And so the defense that was put up at the time, because there wasn't the Architectural Works Copyright Act, was I didn't have access to the actual copyrighted work, the drawing. So they came back in the federal courts, the federal law, the legislature created this act that now says how architectural works include the actual construction. So those are the kind of the umbrella that we're working under. Any type of architectural works falls under the 1990 Architectural Works Copyright Act. I believe there was some modification made in the 2000s, but nothing significant. But that's something, just know that you guys have the architectural world or the design world has kind of their own special subset for copyrights. The third point up on here that's actually pretty important is, and this is again where people may hear about lawsuits that happen from time to time of an infringement. It's only the specific expression of an idea that can be copyrighted. It's not the idea itself. It's how you express that idea. So going back 25, 30 years, one of the more famous cases was, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the Jurassic Park collection of movies. Well, the original Jurassic Park, the original movie, came out of a book written by Michael Crichton. And after, I don't know if it was Paramount or Universal or whatever, the studio that released the very first movie, it was huge because was very unique as a storyline, but also the CGI was the first time they showed like the dinosaurs and everything else, so it was quite spectacular for that back when it came out. And there was a gentleman in California that ended up suing the studios and suing Michael Crichton, saying that he had a book, a very similar book, as Michael Crichton's Jurassic Park book. And so he sued both Michael Crichton and the studio for copyright infringement. When you look, though, at the storylines of the book, while there is a similar story concept that were between the two books, the courts ended up siding with Michael Crichton and the studios, saying that the specific expression of this idea of cloning and bringing back dinosaurs and having this terror affect people. I don't remember if the other gentleman's book also included like trying to create a theme park that was the kind of the storyline in the movie that was out there or not. But they came back and they reiterated this concept that it's a specific expression of that idea. So there's lots and lots of things. If we could copyright an idea, then we would preclude virtually everybody from doing anything on that idea. So they wanted to keep it, the concept is to keep copyrights and the ideas that people come up with open and not copyrightable. It's just how you specifically express it on paper or on a computer program or a song or whatever it might be. So, and then the last point up here is when we talk about is classification of ownership. So, as a default position, we talked about this back when we were going through the B101. The architect or the author is kind of how the Act looks at it, but for purposes of you guys, it's the architect that owns the drawings. If there's no copyright language in the agreement, if there's no agreement, if there's just a work that's out there, the architect or the author is automatically considered the owner of the work, the copyrighted work, the drawings. We talked about the concept of instruments of service in the past, and so what? If you go back and you look at the B101, it references that you are the ownership of the instruments of service. So that includes drawings, specifications, models, all different types of way that you've created the design, the specific intent of your idea for that specific project. So you are the owner of that. The third point up here is a concept called works made for hire. And I've mentioned this in the past a couple times in the lecture, but I wanted to kind of bring it back up again. The work made for hire is where you, the designer, or whomever you might be, are employed. And it could be employed as an individual, or you could be employed as a company. Most of the time it's a specific individual. To create something, and so you are actually hired for that. And the agreement in which you're hired will either say flat out, black and white, the employer is the owner of the drawings, as opposed to you, so it goes against the default position, or the employment agreement may say that you are engaged to perform works made for hire. If that specific language of works made for hire is included, even though they don't talk about the concept of ownership of your work product, the employer will be the owner of the design or whatever copyright that is created. So you are simply hired to be a creator, but you are not hired, and nor will you be an owner of the drawings. It comes up less in the world of architecture, because if you're going to be retained or you'll be working on a project, the works made for hire concept, sorry, comes up less in architecture, because you're going to be retained as someone normally that works for a company or a firm. And when you're working for a company or firm, most of the time your employment agreement or the relationship that you have with that company is that the company owns the work, not you as the individual. And so when that company is employed, even though you're the only one that's working on the design, it's the company that owns it and not the person that hires you. Or there could be a negotiation, and I've done this on behalf of some of my owners, where the owner owns the drawings. So as an example, I've represented McCormick Place and Navy Pier, and they are large governmental agencies, and so when they go out and do a design, they demand that they own the copyrights in the drawings, and anybody that doesn't want to have ownership in those drawings won't end up bidding on those projects. The other reason why, or why normally a works made for hire will happen, let's say you're a sole practitioner, so you don't work for a company, and so you would obviously, by the default position, always own that. Normally you're going to enter into an agreement with that client or customer with hopefully the B101 or some language that specifically says you're the owner. But again, if you ever find yourself, and some of these people, some of you guys, at least this happened with some of my classmates years ago, didn't stay in the architecture world. They went into industrial design or they went into other design things. And so some of the elements that you would see in a B101 don't come up in a contract where you're hired just to do creative design work. If you see the terms work made for hire or work for hire, you'll know that you are not going to be the author, or you're not going to be the owner of the work. You will be the author but not the owner if you see that specific language. And then finally, there can be joint ownership. And joint ownership, again, is not an uncommon thing. It could be joint ownership between you and some of your sub-consultants. It could be joint ownership between you and a developer. You could be a developer yourself and have a relationship with a general contracting firm, and you have joint ownership. Or one of the more famous joint ownerships that existed for many, many years is Steve Jobs of Apple, prior to when he passed away. He had joint ownership on every patent. Again, it's intellectual property. But every patent that he worked on, he had joint ownership with the company Apple. And so when he passed away, those rights, then ownership rights transferred to his estate. And so there are certain patents that are out there that are owned both by Apple and the Jobs estate, which includes his wife, his family, his children, those types of things. So you can have that. Joint ownership, similar to works made for hire, needs to have a specific agreement between the parties. You could have most likely you would have a written agreement, so you could spell out the specific joint ownerships. Like we've talked about over the past, throughout the whole semesters, a contract can be oral. There could be an oral decision between two parties that there would be joint ownership of a copyright, but obviously not recommended given the fact that the specifics of who owns what and what the percentage is and how the breakdown is, you would want that in writing. So, any question on this stuff so far? Okay. Next, after we have the ownership of who owns it, we're going to have a license to use the drawings. And again, we talked about this under the B101, all in Article 7. That specifies in one contract how the license works. Now, what you're going to find throughout your career is you may not always use the B101 or the AIA documents because their license language is consistent from form to form, but you may not be using an AIA form. The company you may work for has their own form. The company that you're engaging with may use the contractor's documents, which are called the consensus docs. They could be using the EJCDC documents, which are created by engineers. So there's going to be a number of different forms that you're going to see throughout your career that may or may not discuss licenses. But the concept is, if we go back to the default position and you are the owner of that architectural work, that copyright, you're the owner of the copyright, you are then going to give a license to someone, to anybody else that wants to use those drawings. And that license, which a lot of people, it's not that they don't understand, they just don't even think about it. On every single construction project that will be built, when a contractor takes the drawings and builds the structure, and this is subsequent to the Architectural Works Copyright Act, but whenever someone builds a structure off of the drawings, they are technically infringing those drawings because they are creating a work which is a copy of what you have drawn from your copyrighted work. And so the copy, the built structure, is an infringement unless the contractor has a license. And that's why the B101 under Article 7 talks about the license and who's able to use it. And that includes the contractor, the subcontractors, anybody that are using those drawings. So you have to have this license to make sure that you are following the rules of copyright. If you don't have that and somebody's using it, then they could make the argument that you aren't really, you've allowed them to use the drawings and there is an infringement. So you want to have this licensure language somewhere in an agreement with that you put together. As it says on the screen, the license is a contractual right. It's not something that comes from a certificate. Like if you think about when you buy, sometimes you buy a product and there'll be a little form inside that has all the instructions of how to use, and then in very tiny, tiny print, there's a whole bunch of stuff that none of us ever read, especially like a computer program, or even what a lot of people don't even understand, when you buy a record, or a record, sorry, when you download music from any place, you don't own that, you actually only have a license to use that music, to listen to that music. Every time you play that, if you didn't have that license, would be an infringement. But since you paid for the download or paid for whatever it might be, that's a license to use that. And so it doesn't have to be a piece of paper. It's a contractual right that's created. If you guys have Spotify, you're like, well, I don't pay for Spotify. I have the ad-free, or I have the ads on Spotify. Well, Spotify has created their own relationship with the artist. And the artist says, I'll give you a license, Spotify, to use my records for a cost. Spotify can, and let you play that for people to listen. And Spotify will then play that for you to listen, but the revenue that it generates from the ads, part of that revenue from the ads will go back to the author, to the author of the song. That's how radio stations work forever, TV stations, everything else. But it's all licensing to use the underlying work. And going back to architecture, we put it in the contracts because we don't have these kind of advertising situations you might have with music or television or movies. But it's a right that doesn't exist automatically. It has to be somewhere out there, a deal between parties. Second point up here is it can be any conceivable combination of rights. It can be the right to play at once, like exclusive. And if we want to keep specifically with architecture, it could be a non-exclusive right. It could be an exclusive right. So sometimes what an architect, and this is what I recommend strongly, is if you have a client that says, I want to own the copyright, and you don't want to give it up. What you say is, okay, I understand that you want this design to be yours and yours only. It's not going to look, nobody's going to build a McDonald's that looks like a McDonald's elsewhere, or nobody's going to build whatever store or whatever house that you build. You don't want anybody to ever copyright that. But as the architect, you don't want to give up the copyright in it for whatever reason. So you then give the owner an exclusive right, meaning while they don't own the copyright, you're not going to use those designs as a whole expression of the idea on other projects. There may be elements of that design, and that's why you want to hold on to the entire copyright. There may be individual elements of that design that you can use in other projects, especially if they're non-distinct, they don't look like the original one. But then that's one way you do an exclusive right. There could be limited rights. There's sort of exclusive, non-exclusive, and there's something in the middle where you say for a period of time or for a geographical location or however you want to divide up the ownership of the rights of who can use it. Sometimes one of the combinations of the rights could be, I'll give you the rights to use these drawings on phase one, but if you want to build a phase two, you don't have the rights to use that unless you come back to me first and ask if I'm going to be the architect on the project. If I don't want to be the architect on the project, you can use it for phase two with a different architect based on certain agreements. But if I am going to be the architect for phase two, you have to pay me these types of fees or what have you. So again, however that license is created, it's as wide open as your imagination and what you want to do protective-wise for your business. Termination of license. Some agreements will identify when a license is terminated. some will not. Sometimes it's terminated based on a period of time. After a certain number of years, the license for the owner to use your drawings on a project terminate. As I just said, if you want to do phase two and you don't engage me, maybe the license terminates there and phase two never gets built according to my drawings. Or there could be a breach in the contract. If, in fact, the architect fails to perform in a timely manner, I'm sorry, not the architect, because the architect's the one terminating the license. If the owner fails to pay timely, or if the owner does something that is a violation of the agreement between the owner and the architect's going to say, look, I can't work with you anymore, and because you own that copyright, you want to hold on to that. And you want to say, I'm terminating your license. I'm not allowing you to use these drawings for your project. And in fact, that was the argument, again, going back to the reflective ceiling plan, the lighting company that I represented. We argued that there was a breach of contract. As a result of that breach, the license, and we looked to the language of Article 7, automatically terminated. We didn't have to write a letter of termination. We didn't have to do a thing. It was an automatic termination. And then, because of that, they were in violation of the copyright because they were using it subsequent to the termination. In our case, we were lucky we didn't have to prove the breach, although we thought we would be able to do that because we ended up settling. We didn't take it all the way to trial, but sometimes you'll have to prove that there was a breach in order to get the automatic termination. But that's an important point. Again, you hold on to that copyright. You, as the architect, hold on to that copyright. And it has leverage through termination to both protect yourself and, if necessary, to collect the funds that are owed to you on a project where you're not getting paid. The last point up here is the owner's agreement to indemnify for non-project use. So let's say, let's go back to this example of indemnification. I'm sorry, of phase one and phase two in the terms of indemnification. So I build you phase one, put up a beautiful tower, and you have excess land, and it's always been your intent to put up phase two. You come back to me for phase two and say, I want to retain you, and maybe we're too busy. Maybe it was a bad relationship before. Whatever the reason why, or maybe the owner doesn't want to engage you, but they want to use your drawings for phase two. Maybe the prices were too much. There's a whole host of reasons. But for purposes of this example, you as the original architect are not going to be the project architect for phase two. But you allow the owner to use your drawings for the second phase. Now, that seems fine because the first phase went up fine and there was no problems, and so why not let him use it, especially if he's going to pay you a fee? So you get a fee for the use of those drawings. It's a certain, and it should be a substantial fee. It may not be 100% of the original fee that you charged for the first drawings, but it should be a substantial buyout fee. But you don't want to stop there. You want to have an agreement with the owner, and this language already exists in the B101, which is good. But the owner says, basically, if something goes wrong while we're doing phase two, and you get sued because you were the designer and the author of the original drawings, if you get sued, I, as the owner, will indemnify and defend you. I will pick up your costs. I will pay for your defense. And if there's a defect and the building falls down or the wall falls down or whatever, I will pay for those costs. And you're like, well, why would that happen? I mean, they're using your drawings, and why should the owner have to pay for if the wall falls down, especially if it was a bad design? And the point, the argument that you want to make is, as the architect of record on the project site, if there was a defect, I would have caught that. In fact, maybe the wall that fell down, you did catch that during the course of the project with the first set of drawings, and you corrected it, made sure that it was corrected in the field. You issued an RFI response to the contractor, and that contractor implemented that response, and they rebuilt the wall. Well, the new contractor, the new architect may not know any of that. And so the wall falls down. Well, they shouldn't be blaming you because you're not there. So that's where, if you're going to let an owner use your drawings, under a subsequent license where you are not involved, you always need to make sure that this fourth bullet here that you get some type of indemnification, that they will pay for your legal fees and they will pay for whatever damages that come up if you get sued, again, because you're not involved. There can be nuances to that. I won't go into much more detail, but if you're ever in that situation, and trust me, it does happen, and I've negotiated a number of indemnity agreements where there's been kind of a separation between the owner and the architect, the original architect. If you're ever in that situation, do make sure that you reach out to counsel and talk about how to protect yourself, because someone using your drawings with your permission, you still need to be protected against a potential lawsuit. Questions on that? Good. Okay. Notice registration of copyrights. So, this is pretty basic. Prior to 1990, the Architectural Works Copyright Act, and then, by the way, there were a number of modifications to the entire Copyright Act, in 1990, there was a specific part for the architectural works that talked about just what we do, but there were a number of modifications. Prior to that, if you wanted to get a copyright in a drawing, you needed to submit it to the U.S. Copyright Office, and you had to have seen the little C. Like if you look down in the corner of the slide down here, you see that little C next to the 2019? That C is a copyright C. Sometimes you'll see an R with a circle in it. That's when that's a registered trademark. So it used to be, by law, prior to 1990, that if any type of work didn't have the C on it, or it wasn't filed with the U.S. Copyright Office, then you didn't have first standing with the prima facie evidence, meaning the prime evidence that you own the copyright in that work. Obviously, people aren't putting circle C's on paintings. They're not putting the circle C on a record. They're not put or even with digital media, any type of thing. That didn't happen. That wasn't happening. So they removed the obligation for you to have put the little circle C on it. But you can still put it as we have it here on these slides, but they've removed that obligation. And by the way, this slide isn't from when I did these slides. This is for the template that I'm using. It's the template for this PowerPoint was created in 2019. So you don't need to have that anymore past 1990. The other thing, interestingly enough, you don't have to have is you actually don't need to physically register your work with the United States Copyright Office. It's a $50 fee, and so think about working for, let's say you're working for a fairly large architectural firm, that would mean every single set of drawings, every plan for every single project, and it's not a lot, but you have $50 on it for every single project that's going out the door, you would build that into the cost of the project for the client, but the paperwork and the filing and the forms and for every single work you would have to do and submit to the Copyright Office would be tremendous. You would have to have someone in your office that would be their sole job is tracking all the copyrights that are issued and all the drawings and works that are copyrighted to be registered with the Copyright Office. So that, and it, by the way, if you didn't do that before, and again, if you didn't do that, don't do that afterwards, it's not that you don't own the copyright in the work. You always will own the copyright in the work. But the notice, the C, or the registration with the Copyright Office gave additional benefits to the owner. And those are statutory benefits. One of the statutory benefits was I can get statutory damages. Let's say that the dollar value of losing my drawings was minimal. There are actual dollar fees that are in the statute that you can recover, which would be more than what you lost in sales. That would be a statutory benefit that you don't automatically get if you didn't have it registered prior to 1990. The other thing would be is if you didn't register prior to 1990 and you made a claim that someone violated your copyright because you weren't registered, you would have to prove that you were the original owner. And then you would be able to say, I have a copyright. So the burden of proof would be on you first, as opposed, and but if you had registered, the burden of proof is on the other side to say they were not violating your copyright. So it's a legal concept. And what they decided in 1990 is, let's get rid of this registration requirement. Let's get rid of the C requirement. The fact that you created this and the fact that you make a statement is that you own it, and the burden has shifted. So you want to make sure, and so they've removed that requirement, which is good. It allows for free more commerce, more freedom of everything else, reduces cost. But if you still, if you find yourself, and this is just a word of caution, if you find yourself where someone has infringed against you, it's my recommendation at that time to then register for that copyright. Take those drawings and submit it and pay the $50 to the U.S. Copyright Office and register it. That way there won't be any confusion or concerns when and if a lawsuit's filed, because it says, I'm the owner, here's my copyright registration, et cetera, et cetera. So simply because you don't have to do it anymore doesn't mean you shouldn't. And if you think about it, any book you read, whether it's electronically or paper, if you go to the very beginning, there's going to be, prior to the title page, there's going to be a copyright page, and that's because the publishing house has got, they do go ahead and do copyright everything. So different organizations, different type of work companies will do, industries will go ahead and copyright no matter what. And so some people do automatically register. You don't have to, but they do. And again, if you ever find yourself in a lawsuit for architectural infringement, go ahead and register if you haven't. Now, how do you get, how do you prove a case for infringement? That's what we have over here for damages. There needs to be three elements here. It needs to be an intentional infringement. The concept there is, I wasn't trying to copy somebody else's work. I just created my own work. I mean, if you think about it, somebody can go out and paint a landscape, and 2 days later, somebody else can come back and paint the same landscape, and you're not intending to infringe on the first landscape that was painted. In fact, both of you have created your own original expression of that idea. So there needs to be proof to prove damages of an intentional infringement. That's the first element. The second element is you actually need access to the work. And this is where there was the, as I talked about the Architectural Works Copyright Act, this is where there was kind of this schism, because people were taking photographs or making measurements of actual structures, and they were saying, we didn't infringe the drawings and specifications. Those were what was filed with the Copyright Office. So we never had access to the copyrighted work. And so the architectural copyright work came back and said, well, the manifestation of those drawings and specifications is the building. So if you are taking photographs or doing measurements of a building, you do have access to the work. And then the third one is, you need to show that it was a violation of that original expression of work. Or on the flip side, you can say that my work, the second work, is my own original expression of the work. So as I gave the example of, I go up and paint a landscape, and I own a copyright in that drawing, someone that comes back 2 days later and paints that same landscape, they may have seen my drawing, my painting. They said, oh, that's really cool. I'm going to go paint that same scene. You could potentially make the argument that they intentionally infringed my expression, my idea of how they painted it or what they saw. You might be able to make the argument they had access to the work and they looked at it, possibly. But the painting itself is still going to be an original expression of the work, the brush strokes, the way the color is. It may not be the exact same copy. So how you do that and how they express that, I could say, yes, I saw that, but I did mine differently. Here are different colors that I used. Here's why it's my original expression versus theirs. And that's a lot of times where the nuances will come in infringement cases. There was the an infringement action dealing with Marvin Gaye, and I believe it was Robin Thicke, a musician, and he used some early music notes from Marvin Gaye songs for one of his songs, and there was an infringement action on that. Vanilla Ice had lawsuits over the fact that he used stuff from David Bowie. There was a lot of different things that people use in music. And sometimes they prevail and sometimes they don't. And it's depending on whether the chords of the music go together, whether that's truly an original expression of work or not. And that will sometimes come down to a jury question. Sometimes it'll be to the experts of how they look at that. So it's a nuance, that last part of whether it's an original expression of the work. But in order, again, to get the images for infringement, you need all three elements that are on the screen. But if, in fact, you are able to prove infringement or show infringement, there are certain, it says damage for infringement, but this should actually say remedies. There are certain remedies that you can recover. The first, and what normally happens in the beginning, is some type of injunction. So when we went in on the reflected ceiling plan claim, we asked for a temporary restraining order. Hold on, let me let Jamax in. We asked for a temporary restraining order. And so, hold on, that went backwards. There we go. So we got an injunction. We stopped the contractor and the owner of the building from using our drawings. The restraining order was that. If, in fact, we had to go further, we would have maybe gotten a permanent injunction. So there can be a temporary restraining order, which is the first step, and then a permanent injunction, which says you never can use those drawings. So that's one type of remedy that you could get. Maybe you don't want monetary. Maybe you just want to have them stop to use your drawings, your original expression idea. Most often, in addition to the injunction, and you use the injunction to get to the second element here, which is your monetary damages. And monetary damages could be in what we have up here is three categories. One, the concept could be is lost profits. So let's say I make a toy, and I'm selling that toy, a million toy units a year, and I'm making a dollar on each unit for my profit. And so I made $1 million in 2024. Now we get into 2025, and someone comes in and they knock off my toy, and they start selling it, and we had projected sales of $2 million in 2025, given the popularity of it in 2024, and we only end up selling $1.2 million. And they end up selling, the competitor ends up selling like $2.5 million, because they're cheaper, because they knocked it off, they didn't have their R&D or whatever it might be. We could sue for a combination of the, based on our projections, potentially our lost profits of the 700,000 units that we didn't sell. We only sold 1.3 of the 2 million. Or we can make an argument that the other side sold themselves 2.3 million units, and we would get the profits on those sales because we lost sales that they picked up. Now, we get into experts about whether we would sell all 2.3 in addition to our 700,000, et cetera, but that's a lost profit analysis that you would get one type of monetary damage. The second would be actual damages. Actual damages might be, if we take going back to the architectural world, let's say someone used your drawings for a phase two. Well, the value of those drawings, of how much it costs you to create those drawings, what you went in to do those, has an actual cost. Those would be your actual damages. Had you been hired by this company, you would have actually created those drawings, and this is your revenue you would have created for that. So those are your actual damages. It can also go down to sales as well, but that's your traditional, your actual is the money that you would have been paid had you been doing the actual work. And then the final would be statutory damages. So statutory damages, as I said, in the act itself, it has a range. I haven't looked at it recently. The cap used to be $250,000, but I think it's gone up since then. But from zero to $250,000. So let's say I just made a painting, and I made it for my own benefit. I wasn't ever going to sell it, so I didn't have any lost profits. And I didn't have any actual damages. But someone takes that painting of mine, and or maybe it's a drawing, and they publish it in a magazine, and they get revenue from that. They get dollars for that.
I never would have sold it to a magazine. So I can't say that I actually would have gotten revenue for that. So my argument is going to be is that even though I'm not in the business of selling my drawings or my paintings, or I wouldn't have made revenue from the... And the other side puts on evidence, says this was just for their personal use or what have you. Even though I would not have done that as part of my business, or it was never my business model, I still am entitled to damages. In addition to stopping them from using it by an injunction, I'm still entitled to damages under the statute, and you put a value on that, and you have to make an argument from zero to whether it's $250,000 or $500,000, the cap. You get whatever the statute says you're entitled to. And the dollar figure will ultimately be, again, a question for the judge or the question for the trier of fact, whether it's judge or jury. But at least you can show that you have some monetary recovery, even if you weren't going to be selling or using this drawing for part of your business. So those are your three types of monetary recoveries in addition to an injunction. Any questions? Okay. Exceptions. So there are exceptions for actually using copyright. The biggest exception is the fair use exception. And fair use says, and it comes into, like I say in the first one here, education. It's not for commercial. It's not profit. So the question is are we using it for commercial reasons? Are we selling it? Are we using it for a nonprofit idea? Can we publish something? And like one of the things you might see when you see a picture in a paper or something or in an image, it'll say from the Getty photographs or Getty, I don't remember what the Getty, but it'll have Getty. You may pay a fee into that generally, but that wouldn't fall under fair use because there's a license to use those Getty ones. But if you, as a student, want to take someone's drawings and use those for your designs and your ideas, as long as you can show it's educational in nature. If you are writing a textbook and you're citing some language out of some other published work, as long as you footnote that and it's educational in nature, you can copy the exact words out of somebody else's work, whether it's from a book, whether it's from a report, a treatise, whatever it might be. As long as you cite the and reference the original author, you can use that for educational purposes. As an example, in my senior year, we were required to design a museum. I used a lot of Richard Meier as an inspiration for my ultimate design. And he had a very kind of classic, I would call it a guitar curve, like if you think about the guitar and the side of a guitar that he used on many of his buildings. I used one of his drawings, and I used the guitar curve for part of my structure. And I used the exact same guitar curve because I thought it fit well into my design, but that was part of my work as a fair use. So you can use it for fair use that way. You also have to look at the nature of the copyrighted work. You know, what is the thing you're going to use? Are you taking chunks of it from a computer program and dumping it in? That may not be something that falls within fair use. But again, if it's something that could be and it lends itself to educational type, that's fine. Then the question also is are you using the whole work or only a portion of it? You could even make the argument that my use of Richard Meier's guitar curve in my project, which had many, many other elements involved with other different ideas that I had that weren't from Richard Meier, I only used one element of it. So was that single element a copyright infringement or was it a fair use? And then the other thing they're going to look at when there's a determination of whether a fair use has been comes into play is does the effect of using it on the market, what's the potential effect of it? You know, if someone copies it and it's not being sold and it's just being used and hung in their house, is there really a damage? Is there something, if something that you can recover from? Is it really affecting your market or their market depending on how the infringement has occurred? And I have gotten many calls over my career where someone says they infringed me, an architect says I was infringed, and then we go through and we talk about the cost of the legal system of what they would do to try to recover, what's their dollar value recovery, and really, will this affect their market share, and do we end up bringing a lawsuit? And I'm never there to try to say you should never bring an action if you're angry enough and there's reason enough you should bring a lawsuit, but If there is a limited effect on the market, it may not be the best argument to be making, especially if the other side could come back and make a fair use argument. Questions on that? Other sections include parity. You're going to see many different drawings or caricatures or other things that are going to be used in magazines or newspapers or other things. So political quotes. Sometimes if you want to use something on a slide, let's say you're giving a presentation and you put up a slide that has a photograph of it. Well, the presentation may or may not be considered educational, but you may be using that illustration for clarity. So those are considered, all of those uses are considered to be a fair use. And you don't necessarily have to give recognition to the author. Like I said, if you're going to be using in a treatise, if you're going to be citing or quoting some language, you would give recognition to the author to keep it within the realm of fair use and educational. But, you know, I've done plenty of presentations where I have photographs up on the screen where I don't have a, you know, an annex at the back end that says I got these photographs from A, B, and C, and I'm doing it in a short hour-long presentation for a bunch of architects over luncheons. That would be exception, would be an exception under the fair use doctrine. So, the last way that you can use an exception of a copyright is actually the copyright itself has expired. Probably the most recent famous expiration was the expiration of The Wizard of Oz. And as when that expired, many things came out, like Wicked when the book was first released and many other things like that. Once that copyright expired, you could do whatever you want with. The other one that just came out that created, I don't know how many people watch horror movies, but in the last 5 years, Christopher Robbins and Winnie the Pooh and all of their characters, those copyrights expired. So now there's actually a Winnie the Pooh horror movie, and Pig was very violent, and Eeyore, and so like there's a couple of those movies out where they've retold Winnie the Pooh in very violent fashions because the copyright has been expired. So the expiration is life of the author, whoever the author wrote it, plus 70 years, so 70 years after the author has passed away. And that's when whoever wrote Christopher Robbins and Winnie the Pooh, he passed away some 70 plus years ago, because I think, like I said, I think it only expired in the last 5 years. And same thing with Frank Baum, who wrote Wizard of Oz. He died back in the teens, I believe, and so in the 70s or 80s is when his work expired, his copyright expired, because it was 7 years after his death, and that's why I allowed for Wicked and The Wiz and a number of other different movies that have come out or works. If the copyright is filed by a company, or if it was a work made for hire, or if someone just has a copyright and there's anonymous, we don't know who created it, but we know it's been copyrighted, that value is the shorter of 95 years from the publication or 120 years in total from when the work was first created. So sometimes that could be longer than the life of the author plus 70 years. Sometimes that could be shorter. So, but there are two different rules. One if you're an individual author. The other is if it's company slash anonymous slash work made for hire when those copyrights expire. Once they expire, all bets are off and you can do whatever you want. I mean, who would think that Winnie the Pooh would be a terror in a movie? But they made it. I've never seen it. I don't know if it's any good, but it's out there just because of the copyright expired. Questions on that? Okay. That's it. That's all you really need to know for copyrights for the exam. So I'm going to turn this off, and then I'm going to spend, I'm not going to go in super, super great depth over the sample letter agreement.